H-O-U-G-H. Now, how would you pronounce H-O-U-G-H? Ho? You? Believe it or not, it's pronounced hock, as though it were H-O-C-K. It's an old Scottish word, and it's in the King James Bible, and that's the way it's pronounced. It's the strangest thing. It's not pronounced anything like it looks. Anyway, what does it mean? Well, the newer versions they say hamstring. What in the world does that mean? You hamstring a horse. Any of you are horse lovers? Well, what is the hamstring? Alright, it's a tendon either in the behind the knee or at the hook. Could be either place. And why would they cut that? What happens if you cut a horse's hamstring? Well, it can walk, but it can't really move about with a great deal of it cannot move about in the way that it would be necessary to move about in war. In other words, it destroys the animal in terms of its usability in war. It doesn't necessarily make it lame. It depends on which tendon they would cut, but it would hobble the horse, in other words. The horse would be lame. Now, why would that be done? Why the cruelty? Why not just kill the horses? Why do you think God gave this instruction to the Israelites, Maida? All right, first of all, it had a very practical purpose, and that was it kept the enemy from making use of horses. Israelites did not use horses at this point in their army. The horse, the first usage of the horse in Israel is referred to in the days of the son of David, days of David. Even David never used horses. One of his sons is the first reference to the use of horses. And then by the days of Solomon, horses had become an integral part of the military of Israel. At this point, the Israelites did not use cavalry or chariotry. And the horse was a very feared animal when used with a chariot or in cavalry units. And so, first purpose, of course, was to hinder the enemy from ever being able to reclaim these horses for use in their military. It's my understanding that the cutting of the hamstring would not kill the horse, but only hobble the horse. And so it was the most humane thing, I think, in terms of the animals, to at the same time to render the animals useless for military purposes, but yet not to kill the animal. That's the order, anyway, that Joshua received. Now, the battle takes place near the waters of Merom. Now, we're not 100% sure what the waters of Merom are. But most authorities feel like the waters of Merom were this little lake just north of the Sea of Galilee, or Kinnereth, as it was called in Old Testament times. That lake is no longer there. It's been drained. It never was a very deep lake. It was more like a marshy area. That water has been drained, but this is where supposedly the battle took place. And as the Israelites won the battle, the enemy began fleeing in various directions to get away from Israel. The city of Hazor was captured and burned, verse 13. Now, we're trying to keep a list of the cities that were burned. We had Jericho was burned, Ai was burned, Hazor was burned, but the cities of the south were not burned. Now, this is very important because if they did not burn the cities and totally destroy the cities, then there would be no archaeological record of the conquest. Because it's only when you totally destroy a city that you leave remains for the archaeologists to dig up years later. If the city was left intact, there would be no evidence of a conquest at this period. Now, we do have some archaeological problems in connection with the conquest. Some archaeologists have said there is no evidence of a destruction of the Canaanite cities at the time of Joshua. Around 1400 B.C., there's no evidence of this conquest. Well, if if in fact Joshua did not burn most of the cities, if in fact that was not his mode of operation, he left the cities intact, he simply destroyed the inhabitants, then we would not expect to find a great number of archaeological ruins that would testify to a conquest at around 1400 B.C. The testimony from Jericho is ambiguous. You have archaeologists that have looked at those ruins and come to different conclusions, and the ruins of Jericho are in such shape now that further study there does not appear that it's going to be very profitable. But basically, that's my answer to the objection that many Old Testament scholars raise. They say, well, there's no evidence of a conquest at 1400 B.C. Well, I wouldn't expect to find archaeological evidence of such because of the fact that Joshua did not burn most of these cities. Recently, some writers have been examining the ruins of Hazor, the very city that we're talking about here, and some, at least, are starting to come back to the date of about 1400 B.C. for the conquest of the Canaanite under Joshua. Now, twice in chapter 11, verse 12, and also in verse 15, there's emphasis on the fact that Joshua was merely carrying out the instructions that were given to him by the Lord. That's very important because some people have really hammered away at Joshua and pictured him as bloodthirsty and as a warmonger and all of that sort of thing. We need to understand that Joshua was simply carrying out instructions from God himself. Unlike Jericho, the spoils of war here in the north were kept by the people of God under permission by the Lord, and so they got to receive those spoils for their own benefits. Now, we want to summarize some important conclusions regarding the conquest of Canaan. Find some maps here and so forth. First of all, we want to notice the geography of Joshua's conquest. Okay, you have a map in your syllabus that looks something like this, and it spells out in Joshua the various areas of the country, the hill country of Judah, the lowland region, are known to geographers as the Shephelah. Goshen is not talking about Goshen in Egypt, but it's talking about a region here known as Goshen, the Negev, or the south country, south of that. Basically, the conquest extended from Mount Hermon in the north to Mount Halak in the south. Halak to Hermon. I don't believe I put the Mount Hermon on the map in your syllabus, so you might want to add that. But that basically is just north of Baal Gad. That basically is the entire area conquered by Joshua. However, it makes it clear, does it not, that there were certain areas that Joshua was not able to conquer, and I've indicated these in green on the map. He did not conquer this area here, known as the Philistine Plain. He did not conquer this area up here, known as the Plain of Asher. There were certain low ranges of the Lebanon Mountains that he was not able to conquer. And then the area here just east of the Sea of Galilee was held by the Geshurites. He did not conquer that area. So those are the main areas that he was not able to conquer during the time of the conquest. Now, the next point to be considered is the point of the chronology of the conquest. And I have that all worked out for you. Put my finger on it right now. How long did the conquest take? Joshua's role in the conquest, yeah, here it is, lasted 7+ years. That's the way I put it. 7+, maybe 7.5 years, a good round number. And we arrive at that figure because of information given to us here in the text of Joshua itself. Let's follow the mathematics on this. It has to do with the age of Caleb at the time of the conquest, and from what is said about the age of Caleb, we can figure out how long it took Joshua to conquer the land. Now we know that Caleb was, let's get all this on. We know that Caleb was 40 years old when he spied out the land of Canaan. That figure is given to us in chapter 14, verse 7. So we put our number 40 out here. We know that Israel wandered 38 years in the wilderness, Deuteronomy 2:14. So we add 38 years to 40. That gives us Caleb's age at the time that they entered the land of Canaan. Caleb was 78 years old when they entered the land of Canaan. Therefore, does everybody follow me there to this point? We know that he was 40 when they spied out the land. You add the 38 years, you get 78 years old at the time that the Israelites entered Canaan. Now, Joshua 14:10 tells us that just after the conquest, Caleb was 85 years old. He was given his own individual territory to conquer, and he was 85 years old. And at that point, the main campaigns against the north and the south were over. So that he was 85 years old. So we subtract 78 from 85, and we get that he was 70. The total conquest then must have lasted 7+ years, a little more than 7 years. So using these figures for the life of Caleb, we can conclude that what we've been reading so far in our course, we've covered a little over seven years of Bible history in the course so far. Now the theology of Joshua's conquest. Let's read chapter 11, verse 15. Mr. Donaldson, for me, please.
As the Lord commanded the servant Moses, so Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did it. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded him.
All right, and then verses 19 through 20.
Except for the Hivites, the king of Gibeon, not one city made a treaty of peace with the Israelites, the good things fall in battle. Pray that the Lord himself and harden their hearts to wage war against Israel, so that he might destroy them totally, exterminating them without mercy as the Lord commanded Moses. At that time, Joshua went and destroyed the Anakites from the hill country, from Hebron, Deborah, and Aiah, from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel.
Okay, I think that's far enough. Now, two points are made here in the verses that were read. One we've talked about already. Joshua, when he exterminated these people, was carrying out the commands of God. And the writer is very careful to say that. It's not his own doing. The second thing that gives people a lot of problem is this idea that God hardened the Canaanites' hearts. Now, we had the same idea last quarter when we talked about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. Let's review that a moment. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Luann, how did we explain God hardening Pharaoh's heart? Bryce?
He hardened his heart so that God could show the people of Egypt that Moses could change their heart.
Now, do you take that to mean, Bryce, that God reached down and forced Pharaoh to resist Moses? He had no choice in the matter? Well, then what does it mean? All right, hands are up all over the place. We'll get you off the hook by asking Mr. Norton.
That doesn't show God's permissive will.
All right, the concept of God's permissive will. God permitted Pharaoh to harden his heart without doing anything to soften his heart. Now, God sometimes can bestow grace and mercy upon an individual to the point that his heart is softened. But God did nothing to soften Pharaoh's heart. He allowed him to harden his heart, permitted him to do so, to his own destruction. He didn't force him to resist Moses. He is still responsible for his action. The same is true with the Canaanites here. God hardened their heart. That is, he permitted the Canaanites to harden their heart. He did nothing to try to soften their heart. So this is the permissive will of God. God does not force anyone to resist. God does not manipulate us like robots. We are free moral agents. We can decide for or against God. Sometimes God does work through the gospel today to soften our hearts. But with the Canaanites, he did no such thing. There, they had been given 430 years in which to repent. More than that, really. And they had not repented. So God hardened their hearts in the sense that he allowed them to go on in their resistance and their rebellion to the point that they destroyed themselves. So be sure you can explain this concept of God hardening the hearts of the Canaanites. If you're not clear on it, let's get it cleared up. Because it's an important concept to get into your mind. There's several other examples of this type of thing found throughout the Old Testament. Verses 21 and 22 speak particularly of the conquest of the Anakim. Why does it spell out the Anakim particularly for special mention in the conquest? Mr. Marshall.
They were the giants. They were so afraid.
All right. The Anakim were the giants. You remember when the spies went in back there in the book of Numbers? They came back and said, those guys are giants. We're grasshoppers in their sight. Obviously a hyperbole. But now special mention is made of the fact, you remember Joshua had said, well, we can take those people, we can conquer them. And now special note is made of the fact that that's exactly what happened. When Joshua got through with the Anakim, only a handful of them were left. They were driven out of the mountains. Only a handful of them were left down in the Philistine plain. One of them will later on appear as Goliath in the history of David. And we'll read about some of these Anakim, these giants from the land of the Philistines a little bit later in our study together. Verse 23 of chapter 11 makes this statement. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. I want to comment on that last phrase, the land had rest from war. That is to be taken in a restricted sense. It certainly was not a permanent cessation of war, because we're going to read about many wars later on. What it means is that the united war effort of all the tribes is now at an end. Individual tribes will yet have to fight battles, which we will study about in the next few days. But the united effort is at an end. 31 kings are enumerated as having been conquered by Joshua. And again, most of these are simply mayors of cities. That's about the size of their jurisdiction. Yes, Mr. Lyon.
So this time,
yes, and we're going to read about how they were dismissed in very short. Okay, now we want to list on the next page of your syllabus some reasons why the conquest of Canaan was successful. And you can almost bank on the fact that you're going to be asked to list these or discuss this question at some future time. So let's note these reasons. The first that I list is the work of the Green Hornet. Well, actually, it doesn't say it was green, so we'll scratch green. But the work of the hornet, 1, 2, 3 places, it speaks about hornets that went into the land of Canaan prior to the arrival of the Israelites. What were these hornets? First of all, I'll say to you, I don't know. Secondly, I'll list for you 3 theories. That the hornets, number one, were actual bumblebee-type hornets. God sent swarms of hornets through the land, sting them all, which sounds a little crazy. The second view is that the word hornet is used figuratively of fear. That fear gripped the hearts of the Canaanites, stung them as if by a hornet. Now that's the most popular view. And they get that from the fact that in some of the verses where the hornets are mentioned, for example, in Exodus 23, verses 27 and 28, the hornet is there found parallel to terror or fear. So some think that the hornet is just a figurative way of talking about terror or fear that would grip the hearts of the Canaanites before Israel got there. The third view, which is very interesting, but in my mind has not yet been completely confirmed, still awaiting one of you to do your research and confirm this view, is that the hornet was the symbol of the armies of Thutmose III, Pharaoh of Egypt, who swept through Canaan prior to the Israelite arrival. And some writers say the hornet was his symbol. And thus what happened is that the Egyptians came through the land and weakened the Canaanites, defeated them, and sort of paved the way or prepared the way for the coming of the Israelites. So those are the three views about the hornet. I'm not sure. It's one of those points that's still up for investigation and research. But the scripture makes no bones about it that hornets, and it uses the plural as a matter of fact, hornets were sent ahead of the Israelites, and something that they did prepared the way for the conquest. Now, the other matters we can talk about very quickly, there is evidence of a lack of unity among the Canaanites. Now you say, well, we just saw about how these cities got together in the south, and the cities got together in the north. Yes, that's true. But I think those are the exception to the general rule. Remember, the conquest went on for 7.5 years. Most of the Canaanite cities hated each other so much they wouldn't cooperate. They wouldn't fight together. Now, we have correspondence. Now, listen to this carefully. We actually have letters that date back to the period that we're talking about. They're called the Amarna letters. A-M-A-R-N-A, the Amarna letters, were found in Egypt a few years ago, and they are letters written to Egypt from these Canaanite cities. And in these letters, it keeps talking about the Habiru are coming, the Habiru are coming. And it doesn't take a great language expert to see the connection between Habiru and Hebrew. And many scholars think that these Amarna letters are actually talking about the coming of the Israelites, the same thing that we read about in the Bible. And from these letters, it becomes very clear that the Canaanite cities were not united. They were actually stabbing each other in the back. And that's part of the reason why Joshua was able to conquer them so easily. Number three, the terrain aided Israel. They were infantry. They used the mountains to advantage. They would swoop down upon the chariot forces of the Canaanites. They did not fight in the plains for the most part. They fought in the mountains where the Canaanites could not use their heavy chariots. Number four, actually there were not very many Canaanites up in the mountain region. That was an assistance to the conquest. Number five, the great powers in this period were weak. Egypt was weak. They were under a Pharaoh who was a religious fanatic at this point. He was more interested in his religious practices than he was in protecting his empire. You see, at the time Joshua invaded the land of Canaan, theoretically the cities of Canaan were under the jurisdiction of Egypt. But because Egypt had this Pharaoh, Akhenaten, who was a religious fanatic, the Egyptians were in no position to come to their help, nor were the Hittites, nor were any other great power of the ancient period. Sixthly, Canaanite society was decadent. We know that the Canaanite religion was immoral, that it fostered and encouraged immorality, and that eats like a termite at the will of people to fight, to resist, and that contributed to Joshua's victory. Number seven, the Canaanites feared Israel. Now, this could be the same as number one, if in fact the hornets are nothing but a figure for fear, but I list it separately. There's no question. You remember when we studied about Rahab? Rahab tells us that all the Canaanites were scared to death about what was going to happen when the Israelites began to march. Number eight. The Israelites were obviously full of great confidence. When you get one opponent that's scared to death and the other opponent that's full of confidence, you have the makings of a great victory. Number nine, the Israelites were numerically powerful. How many men did they count in their army at the last military census that we have record of in the Bible? In round figures. Over how many? Over 600,000, over 500,000 fighting men. Now, some of them may have been left back on the other side of Jordan to guard the families over there. I don't know. But at least we know that the Israelites had a powerful army. And number 10, Israel had a wise and energetic leader. And by that, I'm talking about Joshua, very capable leader. So here are at least 10 reasons that would explain the fact that Joshua was able to so easily defeat the Canaanites. Now, someone says, well, you've left God completely out of this. Well, not really. We understand that God is using circumstances and history to help his people and aid his people. But I think that God brought them to Canaan just at this moment, just at this point in history. And as we look at these factors, we can see why God chose this particular moment, this particular time, to bring the Israelites into the land of Canaan. Mr. Jacob.
Number 9, you said that there were not the powerful. I think when they were talking about the northern kingdom joining forces, it said that there were numerous that stand on the seashore.
Right.
They were outnumbered?
Probably so in that particular battle, but still the Israelites had a sizable force. That's the only point. I'm not trying to say that they were always superior in numbers to the other side. In fact, in some of the battles, they probably were not, but they still had a sizable army. We're not talking about a pipsqueak army here. We're talking about 500,000 men in arms. Okay? Now, you have those listed then, right? Any question or comment on those 10 points? We're not leaving God out of the picture, but we are trying to look at history and see if we can't understand historically why the conquest was so easy, apparently so easy, for Joshua. Now, a couple of points under the nature of the conquest that I want to emphasize to you. One point is found in Judges 3:1. And that is, says the Lord left the nations, quote, to test Israel by them. Some of the nations were not conquered. And God did not defeat anybody that the Israelites would not attack. God expected them to attack these people to win the battles. And if they didn't attack, God simply left those people in the land. And they were a constant test of the faith and the fidelity of the people of the Lord. The second point I wanted to make under the nature of the conquest is that it was gradual. Chapter 11, verse 18 says it took a long time, and we know what a long time is, at least 7 years, a little more than 7 years. Now, a third point I want to make is, that is related to this, is in Joshua 24:31, where the people faithfully served the Lord all the days of Joshua. And this helps to explain the conquest too, that during Joshua's period of leadership, you have the people faithfully serving the Lord. Okay, let's move ahead. Well, one other thing that we normally discuss at this point, and we kind of talked about it the other day, but I want to just systematically get this into your notes somewhere, because this is a question that you will be asked along the way. We did touch on some of these, but let's just get these references down in our notes and these points about why God ordered the destruction of the Canaanites. Point one is that this destruction was based primarily upon religious considerations. And that's important to note that this is not a case of land grabbing of political ideologies in conflict, but rather God is concerned about removing the Canaanites so that his people will not be under influence by them. Secondly, and so very important, we've emphasized this again and again, we say it again, that the conquest of Canaan, the extermination of the Canaanites, was based upon a divine command. Now, every now and then you'll find people that say, well, I can't believe in a God that would order that sort of thing. But the record says he did order that sort of thing. And so we're left, are we going to try to formulate a concept of God out of our own cranium? Or are we going to accept God's self-revelation in the Scriptures? God ordered these people to be exterminated. He has the right to take life away because he is the giver of life. Point three, it was really the Lord who destroyed these people. That's emphasized in the Scripture. He was simply using Israel as his tool or his agent. Point number four, the Canaanites were destroyed because of their iniquity. The cup of iniquity was full and running over. They deserved what was given to them. And finally, this was done to maintain the religious purity of God's people. So these are five points of consideration concerning the justification. And I might ask you on a test, how can you justify? What can you say in defense of the book of Joshua concerning the destruction of the entire Canaanite people? All right, let's go on to our next lesson, which has to do with the division of the land among the various tribes. Now, we've already read, I'm not going to cover all of these points because it's not necessary, but we've already read how God divided the area on the eastern side of the Jordan to two and a half tribes during the lifetime of Moses. Those tribes were Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh. If you haven't gotten that down in your cranium yet, get it down and you see on page 54 of your syllabus a map of that side of the Jordan with these tribes in the proper locations. Now you should be prepared to write all the tribes in on a blank map. Correctly spelled, of course. So be sure you get it in your mind where these various tribes are located.
Do you say blank map? Is that what the dotters are?
Well, they'll have some lines on them.
Yeah, the dotters.
Yeah, right. Okay, now, the tribe of Levi, according to chapter 13, did not receive a tribal area. They had no inheritance because the Lord was their inheritance. However, the Levites had to live somewhere, and we shall see shortly that they lived in 48 cities that were designated for that purpose. I want you to know the leaders in the land division. The leaders were, number one, Eleazar the priest, the son of Aaron. Eleazar the priest, E-L-E-A-Z-E-R. Joshua, and the heads of the households. They were the ones who divided up the land. How did they divide up the land? Well, in chapter 18, we have a reference to a survey that was made of the land. They surveyed the natural boundaries, the rivers and the mountains and that sort of thing, and drew up a map, apparently. And then from that map, they allocated the land by lot. In other words, each of the areas on the map would have been numbered or whatever, and then each of the tribal leaders would have drawn from the pot a number, and that would be their tribal inheritance. That was the fairest way to do it. But remember this, that the land was divided up in three stages. The first stage was that land that was east of Jordan. That took place during Moses' day. The second stage, the land was divided to the three largest tribes, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah. The smaller tribes then were were given their inheritance at a later time. Caleb was 85 years old at the time he was given an inheritance by the people because of his leadership and faithfulness to the Lord. Look at the boast that Caleb makes in verse 11 of chapter 14. One of the great boasts of an 85-year-old man makes a great text to use when you go to an old folks' home. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now for war and for going out and coming in. I like that. The guy's 85 years old, and he hasn't thrown in the towel yet. My teacher called it the grand old prevaricator. He may have been stretching the truth a little bit here. I doubt very seriously if he still had the strength he did when he was 40 or whatever. But I like his spirit. What did he say when they gave him his inheritance? What did he request? What did he ask for? He said, you see that mountain over there, the one that's got the big giants on top of it? That's mine. I want that one. Go up there. Here, can't you see this 85-year-old guy marching up that hill to dislodge the giants? Remember, he was one of the two spies that said, we can take those giants. They all said, oh, we're scared of death of those giants. Caleb said, are there any giants left around here? Let me out. I think he sets a marvelous example for people who get a little older in life. Number one is that he still was out trying to do something. And secondly, he's still looking for mountains to conquer. He's not living in the past. He could have sat around the fire and talked about all the days out there in the wilderness and the good old days back in Egypt and all of this kind of thing, but he's still looking for mountains to conquer. And I like that. Mr. Ryan's dying to interrupt me and ask a question. Well, see, actually, Manasseh and Ephraim are both descendants of, come from who?
Joseph.
And for some purposes, they consider Joseph together. So when we talk about Manasseh and Ephraim, we have to think, okay, Joseph, really, that's Joseph's portion, along with Judah. So you're looking at the two put together, making up the tribe of Joseph, so to speak. Sometimes it even speaks of the tribe of Joseph in the scripture, which means Manasseh and Ephraim combined. Okay. Now, we have a romance here, girls. Soap opera of Joshua. Caleb noticed here that his daughter had her eyes on a young man by the name of Othniel, which means the Lion of God. Now, what relation was Othniel to Caleb? Well, that's a good question. Chapter 15, verse 17 says what? 15:17. Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb. So what relationship is Othniel to Caleb?
Nephew.
He's a nephew, you say. Is there any possibility in your mind that the term brother goes back to Othniel and not to Kenaz, which would make Othniel the brother of Caleb? You have a dispute here among the experts. Some think Othniel was the brother of Caleb. Others think he was the nephew of Caleb. And it seems to me you could interpret the Hebrew here either way. I'm inclined to think he was brother. Inclined toward that view. In which case, he marries a niece. Aksa is the young lady in question. Marriage between uncles and nieces was not all that uncommon. And was not forbidden in the law of Moses. In fact, the later rabbis even stated it was meritorious for an uncle to marry a niece. At any rate, he is some kin. There's no question about that, is it? Either nephew or brother. Take your pick. I lean toward brother. You can make a case both ways. It's ambiguous. Now, what was the... Caleb must have noticed a little bit of an attraction here between this... I noticed some of the girls woke up when I said we're going to have a romance here in the book of Joshua. That's good. Caleb noticed that that Achsa had her eyes upon Othniel and vice versa. And what did Caleb set up as the criteria for the man who would get the hand of his daughter? He who would capture what city? Kiriath Sefer, which is better known to us as what?
Hebron.
Still exists over there today. Hebron, later called Hebron. Kiriath Sefer. The man that conquers that city, I'll give him the hand of my daughter in marriage. Now I wonder what's going through Caleb's mind. What kind of man did she want her, did he want her daughter? What kind of man did Caleb want his daughter to marry? A leader. A fighter. Not a bench warmer. Not a cheerleader. But someone who was out in the middle of the thick of things. And he surely must have realized that Othniel was the man who would attempt such a thing. A man who would go into battle against the city to win the hand of a girl must really love her. He's putting his life on the line, isn't he? He's putting his life on the line for this marriage. So Othniel leads the troops, his family troops, or I don't know where he got any soldiers to follow him, but he rounded up an army. He attacked Kiriath Sefer and he conquered the place, and Achsah was given in marriage to Othniel. And like most young brides, she decided to get as much as she could out of her old dad before she said goodbye. What request did she make of her father as he gave her in marriage to Othniel? She wants what? In addition to the city, she wants some what to go with it? Some water. Now, that would, most girls wouldn't consider that a very good marriage present. But in those days, water was as precious in that region of the country as gold. And the city wouldn't be any good without the water. So she turns the charm on and gets the water from her dad. Now, this story is recorded twice in the scriptures. Here and in the first chapter of the book of Judges. God loves romantic stories, you see. So there must have been a nice romance here between Othniel and Achsah here in the 15th chapter of the book of Joshua. We said Kiriath Sefer was Hebron. That's not right, is it?
Hebron.
Debir. D-E-B-I-R. I checked my notes. Hebron was Kiriath Arba. Those two Kiriaths get mixed up. I get them mixed up all the time. This is Kiriath Sefer, which is D-E-B-I-R, Debir. Okay, what was the status of Jerusalem? Verse 63, chapter 15, at this point in the conquest. Verse 63. Says, now the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah, could not drive them out. So the Jebusites lived with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day. They were not yet able to conquer Jerusalem. Okay, our time is up for today. Those of you who can be here tomorrow, I expect to see you. And those who cannot be, you'll have to get notes or whatever from those who are here as we try to get back on our regular schedule.